This is Tall Tale TV, your podcast for sci-fi and fantasy short stories.
Shade's Shadow by Asaf Mehr. I should not have been out that night. I know better, or at least I should have. There are three unlucky nights in the year. Three nights where the stone slabs over the Mundus Kerialis stood open. An ancient tradition, whose reasons were forgotten, but its ritual strictly adhered to, dictated that the stone doors to this hemispherical pit located in a declivity near the Temple of Keres be opened on three nights, even though they represented the gates to the underworld. A night with, according to custom, the shades of the dead free to roam about. A biting November wind was chilling me to the bones. I was limping home from a rather nasty assignment involving some of society's undesirables, an orphan, an enchanted signet ring, and several pig carcasses. I wasn't planning for it to go that way or for that long, but I did. And now I had to make my way home across the deserted city. The cruelest master would not risk slaves out on this night. Even stray dogs slunk away to their hiding holes, and the sliver of moon hid behind gray clouds. I made my way home as quickly as I could in my battered condition. I took shortcuts. I made a wrong turn. I faced a blank wall at the end of an alley and had to turn back. At the opening of the alley, silhouetted against the sky, was a half-translucent gray shape. It advanced upon me, and I retreated the few steps I could. It advanced farther, closer, closer. I started to mutter prayers to all the Numina I could think of, promising offerings if I lived to see the morning. It stopped 3 paces away from me. It raised its gray arm. It reached with its gray hand to its gray mouth and pulled out the coin that tradition dictated should be used to pay the ferryman to Dis.
"Payment,"
it croaked and reached out its hand with the coin towards me. I stared at it, dumbstruck. The night was clear of clouds and the stars twinkled above us. I could make out the shape of its shade. It was that of a woman. Young, well-dressed, high class, or at least wrapped in a rich woman's funeral shroud. I found my voice at last.
To guide you back to the Mundus?
No,
it croaked again.
Revenge.
By noon, I had almost convinced myself it was a dream. Almost. Because the coin was sitting on my table, the profile of a long-dead consul showing his disdain at my vacillations. I went over in my mind about the details. I tried to avoid exactly how it felt when the shade of this woman, Lykinia, had imparted this information and concentrated on the facts. The time was about 50 years ago, well before I was born. Lykinia was just married to a senator's son, part of her father's political alliances. According to her, marriage was a short, brutal hell. It ended when her husband strangled her one night, during what would have been referred to as rape were they not married. She wanted me to bring him to justice. A 50-year-old case, with nothing but the say-so of a dead woman's shade. And to complicate things, I knew the man. Not personally, no, but I knew of him. Just like everyone else in Egretia, I knew him. He was a famed Roan, former consul, and current censor. Doesn't get more famous than that. After 50 years, there was no way I could find evidence to tie him to her murder. Neither could I bring him to court for it, because as paterfamilias, he was within his rights to treat her as he liked, even kill her. which, apparently, he did. But that coin, and that voice, and the memory of those haunting, luminous eyes in the gray face. I had two options. I could try to bring him to formal justice on Lykinia's behalf, or any other charges that might get him exiled or executed, or I could exact a more direct revenge. Public humiliation in the courts would have been ideal, but I doubted my chances of successfully bearing suit against him. I decided to get his measure first.
"Start with the slaves. Always start with the slaves,"
was the advice I got from an old mentor. I found his domus, situated high up on the slopes of Vergu, and lurked about. There was plenty of traffic coming in and going out of the house. The hour was early afternoon. Slaves and freedmen were finishing up their errands and returning. Messengers were going back and forth, and even some respectable citizens and minor dignitaries, no doubt clients of the master, were still coming and going. I was munching on a squid on a stick bought from a nearby stall, considering whom I should approach first, when I saw a muscular man come out of a side gate, pushing ahead a wheelbarrow containing some old sheets. He was accompanied by a slender girl, a slave as well by her short tunic. They never spoke, they never looked up, just trudged along, slinking on the side of the street. I have no idea why, but I felt a chill as they passed me. I was drawn to follow them, and I did. We walked down the mountain, the slaves leading in silence, and me following behind. They reached the Porta Alta, the gate in the city walls on the road that leads up Vergu. A short distance later, they took a small track that branched left and down the hills and towards the Fulvius River. It has fallen into disuse over the years, the majority of human traffic going through the city streets. They quickened their pace, and though the path was broken, their steps were lighter. I had the impression they were glad to be away from other humans. I kept a respectable distance as we walked, though they seemed to care little. When we reached the flat grounds, close to the river, I was not surprised they were not interested in any of the small gardens, minor estates, and occasional trade posts that lay outside the sacred perimeter of the city. They kept going, avoiding people, heading to the river. We reached the Pons Moors, an old wooden bridge with a foreboding name to match its history. They crossed it and started to trek up the hill towards the sacred hill of Libitina, where the records of the dead and the graves of the poor were. They made their way to the lie pits, where unclaimed corpses are discarded. I took out a writing wax tablet I keep to take notes, quickened my steps, and got to them just as they stopped next to an open pit.
"Excuse me,"
I said and put my hand out. The girl recoiled as if I struck her, while the man pushing the cart froze completely. I softened my tone.
"I did not mean to scare you. I just need to ask you a few questions."
"Please, Domine. My Dominus instructed us to be quick about our task," she answered without lifting her eyes.
"That's all right. I just need a name and cause of death for our records."
I waved the wax tablet.
"She was called Victoria," said the girl.
"Grand name for a slave."
"Our Dominus likes to name us after the gods."
"And the cause of death?"
I asked, and flipped over the rags covering the body in the wheelbarrow. And immediately I wished I hadn't. A short, curvy girl, long brown hair framing a face of which brown eyes stared out unblinking, never to see again. The slave girl didn't answer my question, but the scars were obvious. The poor girl had been whipped over the years, certainly, but that was not what finally killed her. On her fair skin, I saw the same scars I've seen before at military sieges, though these looked deliberate. She was slowly and repeatedly scalded by hot oil, the red burn scars snaking around her young body as someone flung the oil at her time after time. Her legs, from the knees down, looked like they have been boiled in the oil. I could not imagine the workings of a twisted mind that would do such a thing to a defenseless girl, though I would guess he was getting off by savagely attacking symbols for gods.
"And who shall I write as brought her here?"
I asked after I covered the body back with the rags.
"He calls me Concordia. He said I am next," she said without lifting her eyes or showing any emotion.
It was almost a month later when I had everything in place. On the start of the last Nundinus of December, on the day and night we celebrated the mythic woman Acca Larentia for having nursed the three brothers who founded our city. This winter celebration is on the side of the ending year, and thus most offerings are for the dead. I made her my own offering in advance, all as prescribed. I asked her favor to speak on my behalf with Dea Taquita, the Mute One, Goddess of the Dead, for they share the same festival day. This matter concerned Dea Taquita, for it was the shades of the dead girls that were denied their eternal rest, but I was not so rash as to apply directly to the Mute One. I had to organize things carefully. I had to coincide any ceremony I would carry out with general festivals, so as to hide behind the noise of public magia and escape the notice of the Collegium Incantatorum. Understand, the times where everyone sacrifices for the gods, even when the magia is not properly directed and the public ceremonies are bordering more on superstition than on real incantation, still provide me enough background noise to mask any dark deeds. On the celebration of Laurentalia, the censor was invited to be present at the rites carried out just outside our walls, on the wide ledge where funerals are held. This was one of the progression of special events making the end of the year, a necessary ceremony to propitiate the Numina and ensure that a new year will start after the Intercalaris, that countless period over the winter between December and the beginning of the new year on the first new moon of the spring solstice. I was standing to the side of the sparse crowd of citizens, farther up the slope and away from the city. The censor, resplendent in his white toga with wide purple stripes, the brass buckles on his crimson shoes flaring with the last rays of sunlight, was standing at the center of the row of dignitaries, as befitting his position, with a look of boredom and disdain that betrayed true feelings. When the rites were over, I uttered a small incantation and spoke his name softly. The wind sighed and carried it to his ears alone. He turned his head. Behind me, two girls, one dressed as Diana, the other as Fortuna, disappeared quickly behind a bend in the road. He stared at me for a moment, shook his head, and turned. I signaled the girls and spoke the incantation again. As he turned, the girls looked up, laughed, and ducked back behind the rock. I walked towards him, slowly, keeping my eyes locked on his, letting the crowd wend their way down the hill and leave us alone. He stayed, mesmerized, looking at me and the tantalizing visions of girls and goddesses' costumes peeking behind me, and dismissed his retinue with a wave. The men around us hurried down before full darkness set in. By the time I reached him, we were alone.
"I've heard you're in the market for some slave girls, particularly ones that know how to dress up and act like goddesses," I said.
He stared at me for a moment, licked his lips, and said,
"I'm not sure what you mean. I have a young woman to sell. Well-read, cultured, pretty. Her father was forced to sell the family into slavery to repay a gambling debt. Can recite Andronicus and Terentius. Likes to dress up as Diana the Huntress. Give her a bow, and she'll look just like a temple statue."
My sources and hunches were right, for I could see him waver.
"I have her right here for you. You can check her out, sample her recitation skills. It won't take a moment."
He followed me. We went just around the bend.
"Just in here."
I pointed at a shallow recess. He just wasn't expecting me to hit him on the side of the head with a leather pouch full of sand as I turned to show him the way. I caught him as he collapsed. I tied him down with special leather tongs that have been inscribed with the sigils marked by teeth. I laid him neatly in the recess, in the center of a circle drawn in blood and bones. We waited for the moon to rise. He woke up. He threatened. He pleaded. Threatened again. Cried. The waning moon finally sailed past the peak of Virgu to light our little hollow on the western side. I chanted the necessary prayer. I made the right sacrifices. I gave it direction and focus, beyond mere superstition, yet without the callous hubris of an incantator channeling the magia. I stood back. We didn't have to wait long. Deeper shadows amidst the scree shifted, morphed, advanced. With halting movements, in bursts that seemed to always be at the periphery of my vision, shadowy figures drew closer, until finally they resolved themselves into human shapes, rising from the rocks to stand around us. Against their gray skin, I could make out the luminous yellow eyes, the webbed hands, the sharpened teeth. They looked at me unblinkingly. I spoke the last words of the prayer, promising the Dea Takita that which was hers, and backed away. Their eyes shifted from me to the gibbering censer in the center of the circle, and descended upon him. Beyond the circle of writhing bodies, I saw the gray shape of the Kenia, looking emotionless at her killer being killed. I took out the coin from the fold of my toga, looked again at the face of a long-dead consul. I balanced it on thumb and forefinger, and flicked it above the circle and over the gray lumeris at Lakinia. She caught it deftly, placed it in her mouth, and began to fade away. I could almost hear a faint, "Thank you," over the sounds of ripping flesh and crunching bones. I turned away and made my way down the mountain, back into our city and its lights, towards the nearest cup of wine, hoping that Lakinia would now find peace across the river Styx. Asaf has had his nose in a book since he was 5. So it wasn't surprising that he turned to writing. All those years of reading of ancient Rome, sci-fi, fantasy, and mysteries, while practicing various martial arts, traveling the world, and working odd jobs, led to some interesting combinations in his stories. He now writes the Stories of Togas, Daggers, and Magic series, for lovers of ancient Rome and dark urban fantasy. His works have been amazingly received, with acclaims from both Roman-era detective authors and fantasy aficionados. Richard Knack of Dragonlance fame has said, "Murder in Absentia by Aussie writer Asaf Mehr is a skillful blending of historical fantasy with mystery set in a realm very much like ancient Rome. Mehr creates a vivid cast and an equally vivid setting, in which magic just seems to fit in perfectly. Ruth Downey, the New York Times best-selling author of the Medicus series, Mare's imagined world, based on ancient Rome, feels at once familiar and dreamlike. In Agricia, magic is real and potentially deadly. Failed incantator Felix the Fox is investigating a mysterious death in a growing atmosphere of menace. I can't help thinking the idea of death by magic might be closer to the mindset of some of the ancient world than our own modern rationality. One of the things that I love about running this channel is occasionally I get to read stories with settings or concepts that never would have crossed my mind. From retro supervillain Cape Punk discos to now ancient Roman murder mysteries. As soon as the author described this to me as Harry Dresden in a toga, I was sold. Go and check out his book on Amazon. It's got 4.5 stars with a ton of amazing reviews. For anyone interested, I'll leave a link in the description. And just a reminder, this show is available on both YouTube and podcast formats. This way, you can listen wherever it fits your lifestyle best. For more details, visit talltaletv.com. I'm Chris Herron, and that's it for today's Tall Tale TV.